Hello and welcome to another episode of the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. In this episode, I speak to Bill Wilson of Midwest Permaculture. Several years ago, when I began looking for a permaculture design course, Bill Wilson's name kept popping up as I searched the web and asked around. Given that he and his team have facilitated around 30 PDCs, now it makes sense. And because of that, I've had an interest to speak with him for some time, and I'm thankful for the hour or so he spent with me to make this show. I begin, as I often do, with his background and how he came to permaculture, which, as with all of the guests, was a unique road. The rest of the conversation winds and weaves through the impacts of agriculture on the environment and our community, through to the permaculture design course, his methods and curriculum, and what he sees as the major areas of permaculture. Around this time, as we speak about what goes into making a permanent culture, I lose the connection and we pick up back at that point and proceed to the way he approaches curriculum while honoring the work set forward by Mollison and Holmgren and identifying the need for an evolution in that material over the 30 years since it was first released into the world. Perhaps, though, the most powerful part of all of this is as we begin to wind down and speak about right livelihood and finding your personal authenticity so that you can contribute to the world and grow, because you must do both. May you enjoy this time with Bill Wilson as much as I did. On to the interview. Before we get into the meat of the interview, why don't you go ahead and give me and the listeners a bit of your background when it comes to permaculture, and I guess from there your organization, Midwest Permaculture, and the work that you've been doing the last couple of years?
Sure. Well, let's start with my interest in permaculture. I'm right around 60 years of age now, and it really started when I was young. About 22, 23, I was living in Montana at the time, and I was introduced to the concept of intentional community living. Some folks were had a piece of land, and they were going to try to set up a small village on there. And that whole idea of living more simply, and living with intention, and cooperating just made so much sense to me. I don't know, why, but it just did. And so from that point on, I started looking at alternative ways of living on the surface of the planet. I was born and raised in a suburban situation, and it's pretty much just a product of the culture. As I like to toy with or play with this idea of just being raised on white bread and cornflakes, and not really having an original thought till I finally left and got out of that situation. So it was like living in a little bit of a fantasy world to me, and so when I started looking at alternatives, they felt more real. Looking at alternative health, looking at diet and how it really affects us, looking at how we educate ourselves. Why do we have to go through institutions or that kind of thing? And certainly there's a place for higher learning, but it's becoming less and less relevant to many people in our culture. So anyway, that just set me off on that journey, and I learned about a community in Illinois when I was about 27 years old, 28. And they were doing many of the same things. They were starting as an intentional community. It had kind of very lofty goals. It was more of a utopian image. And it had kind of a suburban flavor to it, which I wasn't too keen about. But the intention was good. The idea of how do we live more consciously? How do we live even more lovingly? I don't want to, kind of talk about that as a mushy thing. But seriously, as how do we care for one another? How do we care for people? How do we care for the planet? And how do we care for the future? So I came to Illinois, and that's how I got involved in kind of deeper into sustainability, community, authentic living. And so that's been kind of a life pattern. So I've been in this small town of Illinois for 34 years. The community is no longer a closed intentional community. It's been an open town for like 30 years. So many communities, when they start as, with a strong focus, and they attract a lot of folks. But like many of those communities, we could agree on a vision, we just couldn't agree on how to get there. And so after a lot of trial and error and just tension, a bunch of people left, and we created a homeowners association. So there's about 110 people that live in our town now, and it's very small, out in the middle of nowhere in Illinois, surrounded by corn and soybean fields. But because it is a little bit isolated, with just maybe 20 or 30 of us in town that are really interested in different aspects of permanent culture or sustainable living or community, we created a really nice place to live. So that was my interest in it. And fast forward, I've had a variety of jobs. I had several businesses. And in 2004, I took a permaculture design course. We have a nonprofit in our little community of Stell, which I was involved in. And we invited David Bloom to come in and teach his 14-day design certification course. Well, I went through that course, and when I came out, the bells and whistles had gone off. Things lined up for me. I got a real strong sense of not only a sense of clarity for myself, but a sense of clarity for what's possible in the future. I think many people like me ached for a more compassionate way of living on the planet, where we weren't just destroying and polluting everything that we touched. But I couldn't see the path to solving the problem. I figured they might be there, or they should be there, but everywhere I turned, the challenges were so huge, I couldn't imagine how we were going to solve these problems. Well, that's what permaculture, the gift of permaculture was, starting with a very simple ethic, very simple principles. We literally can design ways of living that not only can solve the problems that surround us, but we actually can be a positive force on the planet. We actually could leave the planet in better condition than when we arrived on it. You know, that's the old Boy Scout motto, you know, leave your campsite in better condition than when you found it. Well, what if every generation of humans, you know, who came onto this planet, you know, we had two objectives, you know, or two responsibilities. And one was to live incredibly abundantly and to experience the wonderfulness of being alive on this planet, because this really is an amazing place to be and to live. But the other thing we have to do is we have to leave it in better condition than when we showed up on it. If that was the, you know, the precept of our culture, then we would be living pretty much in a utopian situation today. But instead, we've done just the opposite. In successive generations, we continue to degrade the environments that we come across pretty much since the advent of agriculture. You know, after about 10,000 years, there have been quite a few studies that have shown that it's with the advent of this process of annual cropping, throwing in a seed and trying to develop a single crop, that a lot of our community experiences started to dwindle away, and we became much more Apollonian, I guess you would say, or authoritarian in our community designs and approaches. That's subjective, and there are other people that have maybe other opinions on that, but it is pretty true that the Middle East and most of North Africa were once very fertile areas, but as the populations grew and this process of annual agriculture where we just turn the soil year after year, eventually you will lose the topsoil. It's just the way it is. It may take a generation or five generations or 1,000 generations or, you know, 100 generations. But if we continue to turn the soil, there are those years where it's exposed to wind and sun, and it's just gonna go. And it's hard. It takes a lot of time to build up the topsoil that you can lose in just one rain event. So that's what's happened around the globe, and a lot of the, areas that we, farm around the planet, all the arable land, we're slowly destroying it through industrial agricultural practices. Not that farmers are bad people. Some of the best people I know are farmers. They're my neighbors. But, you know, it's that practice of annual agriculture that we really have to lead. And we're all in this together. I mean, you know, most of us still drive automobiles, and that's part of the problem as well. So the idea behind a permaculture design is, how do we find ways of living abundantly well, whereby we can leave the planet in better condition because we were there? And through the permaculture design course, I realized it was possible. So I got excited about it, and I just told my wife, I said, you know, honey, I just need to do this work. I need to somehow figure out a way to get the ideas of permaculture out and about. So that's what we did, and that's how we started Midwest Permaculture.
And you started Midwest Permaculture then, was that shortly after 2004 when you took your PDC?
Yes, it started, well, it kind of, Midwest Permaculture was really started in 2006. In 2005, we hosted some other workshops. I had met Mark Shepard up in Wisconsin. He's an excellent teacher and done some great work. So I invited him down. He did some workshops for us. And then I met Wayne Weissman, heard about Wayne. I went down to Southern Illinois to meet him and saw his knowledge base as well. So I invited the two of them to teach a design course in 2006. So the two of them came to Stell. Becky and I basically hosted it, and it was a very successful training, and students got a lot out of it. It was actually at that training we were having a hard time to find, you know, 13, 14 days where both Mark and Wayne could be present. And Becky and I had quite a bit of experience before that in other educational venues where we did some trainings through using the telephone and the internet. and knew that it was very effective. And so I suggested to Mark and Wayne that we do some of the training ahead of time using a webinar platform and sharing, you know, they could share the slides and the whole nine yards. And it was very successful. So we ended up packing our design course into 8 very full days. We go morning, afternoon, and evening. But it was possible because we had done all the pre-study. So a lot of the textbook stuff, a lot of the foundational stuff is already covered. And then when people show up, we actually can get into doing some hands-on things and looking at other pieces of the curriculum that are better to do in person and you know, through exercises.
Are you, because I'd like to speak with you about teaching permaculture as part of this, are you still using that model of doing the textbook work and pre-work before people come out for your PDC?
Yes, absolutely. One of the things we've done is over the years, we've been at this almost 6 years now, we've recorded a lot of interviews with other permaculture teachers, or not even so much permaculture teachers, but people who are doing permaculture type work, and they don't even know the word permaculture. Just fascinating folks. But as well as, you know, just other webinars that we have done where we've got quite a bit of the curriculum together. And so we recorded those webinars. So now we have a Foundations of Permaculture webinar series, which is about 16 hours of recorded webinars. And is included with some handouts and a study guide that goes with the textbook that we use for the design course, which is Rosemary Morrow's book, Earth User's Guide to Permaculture. So students get that package ahead of time. Most design courses, we have a couple of live webinars we do ahead of time, so students get to meet one another and answer questions and go over some key material. And then they come to a training and we hit the ground running. It's pretty intense, but it's really a lot of fun. Very fulfilling experience. And I guess we should talk a little bit about, you know, what really should be covered in the design course and how long does it take? Because there is some question about that.
There's some material that I recorded before was about what to look for when looking for a PDC because of some of the questions that have evolved about itinerant teachers, what you should look for in a class. You know, how much of it is supposed to be hands-on, how much of it is designing in class, how much of it is lecture, field trips, all that. So yeah, that would be something great to cover, especially because of that framework that it's supposed to be like 72 hours of instruction. So how do you break that down? How does that work for someone who wants to take a PDC? And it sounds like you've kind of developed your own model for that using this pre-package before folks come to your class. Mm-hmm. So what do
There's a couple of things that we're after, and we've done over 30 trainings, and so none of them have been the same in that we constantly are working on trying to improve them. My goal, I have really one goal, and it's really not to cover every single piece of item in a design course curriculum, but rather for students to walk away with the greatest amount of information and knowledge and useful information that they will apply and actually begin to do things. We have had, you know, we do offer our training to people who take it as a review if they've taken a design course before. And I know from my experience, I was very inspired by my design course. But when I came out, I was confused. I did not know where to start. Even though I'd gone through a design process and we, you know, design course, I think, you know, what do I do in my own backyard? What do I do? You know, I know how to, you know, landscape a 200-acre piece of property on a hillside somewhere. But what do I do in my own backyard? It's the extrapolation process. So what we've done is we continue to cover the full curriculum, but we don't spend 3 hours on keylining. We'll spend maybe an hour on keylining, and I'll end up spending more time on how do you hold water in your own backyard? What are all the different methods for doing that? Moving water on the landscape on your own property. We'll do, instead of doing design exercises for large pieces of property, we'll focus on a community garden. We'll focus on a standard urban lot. We'll do a plant guild. We'll do a variety of plant guild exercises. So people say, well, this is what I have in my yard. These are the kinds of trees I have. Well, great. Let's design around those trees. What can we do? And then that's how we teach the, you know, about plant guilds and about stacking functions and that kind of thing. So I feel like what we've tried to do here through our trainings in Midwest Permaculture is to honor the curriculum because it is brilliant. I mean, the way Bill laid it out and the elements in the design, we cover every piece because it is the way it's laid out, it builds. But when it comes to examples and getting students experience, we tend to move it towards what is practical to the person in the room and how are they going to apply it. But even though we do that and we have maybe a strong urban environment, a strong urban emphasis on some of our examples, we do have students that go home on large acreage and do tremendous work. We've got a couple of students that have gone overseas and started projects in other countries. So it's, I feel like we're honoring Bill's work, and David Holmgren's work in saying, look, what we've created, 30 years ago is a really great thing. But if it was to stop there, we would be doing a disservice to the country, to the future. That permaculture needs to evolve just like everything else. So that's been our mantra, is to honor the curriculum, but bring in pieces to the curriculum that drive the concepts home so that when people leave, they got it. They got permaculture and they know what to do. And I feel like we've done an excellent job at that, very good job at that.
That you have enough of a base, your students have enough of a base understanding from the package that they begin with before they come to the class, that you're then given the liberty and the freedom that you can adjust what's going on in class to meet their individual needs. That it's not a rote learning exercise where you're lecturing and it's like, and now here's patterning and here are examples of patterns. It becomes more of a dialogue between you and your students so that they can answer their own questions while in class.
Yeah, there's definitely some of that. We can't tailor it to everybody, of course.
Right.
But we even have a segment in our design course. We devote an entire evening. We have students bring in their own personal design projects. Not everybody will have one, but usually half to two-thirds do. And then we break the students up into group, and we have them brainstorm each other's personal project. So it's a way to get, it's really about exercising your design muscles. We bury people with a tremendous amount of information in the pre-training and when they come in and they start doing, lecture process. And so how do we make it come alive? And the way you make it come alive is have them apply it, have them sit down. And I don't feel like one design exercise is enough. Throughout the course of a week, we have 4, 5, or 6 design exercises that we want to have students do because that's where it really anchors the experience. So then people go home and say, oh, yeah, I designed this, I designed that. I know what to do here. I know what to do there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can think to my own work. I've redesigned my own property 5 or 6 times. As I implement something and something changes, out comes the paper, out comes the materials, and then I learn something new through that process.
Oh, absolutely. That's exactly how it works. There's just no way to know everything. You can't do it. It'll never happen. But and you can't anticipate everything. But you certainly can lay out on any kind of design. You know what the basics are. Through the scale of permanence, we know what the critical things are. And we know how to move water. We know how to deal with sunlight. We know how to improve the soils and, create access and things like that. So we can design those pieces, but we have to pay attention to what's actually happening and be willing to make adjustments. And when we're talking about polycultural systems, it's we're talking about the plant community, it's just wonderful what shows up. Things just show up and do really well, and you look up that plant and you realize, oh my gosh, look at all these benefits to this. This part is edible, this part is medicinal, and this part is an insectary. My gosh, let's keep this plant here. It wants to be here. If you weren't willing to do that, you would miss a huge opportunity.
Yeah, I took a... Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say that also when we approached the design, we approached a design course. I've kind of broken permaculture into 4 major areas, and I like to focus on all 4 of those areas because it makes it more understandable, I think, to the student. And one thing I tell them is I say about 25% of permaculture is about the plant community and all the different things we can do with the soil and with plants and how do we work with the natural ecosystems. But another quarter of permaculture design is about energy and water. How do we use water? How do we use energy? Where do we get it? How many, mountaintops do we blow up to be able to turn on a light bulb anytime we want? We need to look at the sources of these. It's a huge piece in our culture. Energy is huge. Third, I like to look at the built environment because they say that in the housing and construction fields, if that's where 40% of our waste comes from, is in our houses and how we build them. So we need to look at, let's not build a house that's going to last 100 years. Let's build a house that's going to last 500 years. And when it's done, it goes back to the earth and there's no little or no pollution in that process. And then the fourth item, I say that, permaculture, permanent culture is really about people. It doesn't matter how many of these systems we put into place. And I experienced that in our own community here. You know, it doesn't matter how much you've got on the ground if you can't work together. If you as individuals don't know how to get along and how to communicate fairly and even compassionately and understand one another, these things just fall apart. And there is no permanence there. The human element, the social environment, is every bit as important as all these other pieces. And I think a lot of, I've heard quite a few other permaculture teachers give voice to that. It's not something I remember hearing Bill talk much about, Mr. Mollison, but that kind of makes sense. In the early days, it was really about how do we do it on the physical planet? If we chose to do it, how would we do it? And so Bill and David gave great examples and great work in that area. And I think in subsequent years, David Holmgren has done a lot in looking at the social aspects.
But we were talking about the social aspects of permaculture before we got cut off. You were talking about how Mollison and Holmgren had laid out plans for the physical planet, but then Holmgren was working on the social aspects as well.
Yeah, so in subsequent years, we realized that a lot of systems, regardless of what we put down on the ground, if people can't hold it together, even from a family perspective, you know, people put things in the ground to get things started, and then everybody walks away. Fortunately, some of these systems that once you put on the ground, once they're there, even though people walk away, so sometimes they can still be very productive. And oftentimes, went into a small community and nobody had done anything for 12 years, and yet here are all these fruit plants and berry plants packed into this piece of property, still growing and still producing. So, but the social aspect, we need to pay attention to that. And then there's not a lot of time in the design course to do that, but we do have to give it service. We do have to let people know that how we work together, what kind of systems we create. We emphasize cooperatives quite a bit in our training, explaining that, it's through cooperation that we really create a tremendous amount of strength and security, not through competition, which is just reverse of, I think, what our culture teaches us. So anyway, but by dividing up the curriculum into those four areas, it gives students a sense that permaculture is a lot more than just, where do I plant my plant? Obviously, that's an entry point for permaculture. A lot of us learned about permaculture because of our interest maybe in growing food or even developing a landscape. But when you look at, what is it going to take for us to create permanent cultures, well, then we have to look at the whole thing. So I think a design course should address, all those aspects, and we do. And our students appreciate it. That's the feedback and you get from them.
Well, during my PDC, we had some conversation about alternative economics. One of my fellow students was an economist by training, and he and someone else came in and gave a several-hour lecture on alternative economies and things that we could do then to build community without necessarily money through systems like time banking and such. And I know through some of the interviews that I've had recently, some of the new material that I've been reading on permaculture, that there's a lot more discussion about that building of community and that idea of working on the self and seeing the larger culture as one of the zones then, so that you have yourself as like the zone zero, and then you have your family as, zone one, and so on out from there, so that you have these areas that you're interacting with. And one thing that keeps coming up is a need to be able to communicate differently.
Right.
And nonviolent communication is one that's come up several times as a means to do so. And it's interesting to see that change from the big tome and Mollison's early work and where we are now with some of the later material that's being developed currently.
Well, didn't Ethan Rowan, I think you've interviewed him recently, and he did some great work on financial permaculture.
Mm-hmm.
And we're really looking at the different aspects of capital. It's not just finances that creates a sense of abundance in one's life, but many things contribute to that. And one is our relationships with others. If you're well liked, and people appreciate who you are, you tend to be cared for.
Mm-hmm.
There's the capital we build just from knowledge, just by what we know and our ability to contribute to others. That's a huge form of capital. So, I mean, he broke it down into eight different categories. And, I thought it was really brilliant the way he did it. A matter of fact, we came across it not long ago, I think, and we ended up sharing his work at our last design course and linking people to his website. So to me, that's right on the money. And that this is the kind of work that we have to do as permaculturists. We have to move the conversation about permaculture forward so that it's practical. I think what Becky and I have done is even though we kind of come out of a counterculture thinking or alternative culture thinking, I guess is what I would say, I think that permaculture wasn't able to be understood or accepted by mainstream thinking because it looked too radical, too different. And so it just hasn't had the momentum or been picked up. I mean, to me, I'm just stunned that, you know, it's been around 30 years and, you know, it's not part of every, you know, junior high school and high school curriculum. So I feel like it's our responsibility. And I feel like one of the things that Becky and I have done is, we've kind of maybe changed the language a little bit and approached it from a different perspective that I can walk into a room with people from a mainstream experience and have a conversation about permaculture and not freak them out, you know, not, you know, appear as some kind of a, you know, a radical or just a back to the lander or something like that. And that's why it's relevant, you know, how do we get our energy? How do we relate to one another? You know, those are all, you know, how we build our buildings. Those are all part of you know, creating a permanent culture in the future. You know, the Rob Hopkins from the Transition Town movement said it really well. He said that, you know, we really have to we have to take a look at our culture and rethink and practically retool the way we do almost everything. It's a huge task, you know, what's before it. But the alternative to not doing it is not very exciting. I mean, it's not only is it going to, you know, destroy the natural world in many ways, and possibly, you know, it looks like we're changing our environment the whole nine yards, but it's not very much fun either. The culture we've created, we've traded an authentic experience of being alive and actually, you know, getting a charge out of life to being consumers and spectators. I mean, I did that for a while, but there's only so many things you can consume and only so many ways you can be entertained, and it all gets boring after a while. At least it did for me. And I ached for a more authentic experience of being alive on the planet. Otherwise, why bother? It just got that bad. So it was that path that spurred me on to thinking about a lot of these things. And 20 years later, I discovered permaculture, and I thought, well, this is a vehicle that there's a way to explain that it is worthwhile waking up and being conscious and alive on the planet. It's a much greater experience. It's much more wonderful than just being a product of the culture. So anyway, but that has to do with the design course, and that is bringing that element in. I know that even in the early days, Bill talked about how the culture we live in is just not, you know, it's just not going to make it. It's just darn right destructive. And so what I'm trying to do is also be sure that we communicate that, but also that we show the incredible possibilities behind permaculture design or permaculture thinking. It is brilliant. It is incredibly invigorating to know that there is a path and a way to do it. And that's one of the exciting things, I think, that to me, I told Becky, I said, if we're going to do this, I said, students got to come out of our course not confused. They have to come out of our course feeling clear and inspired. And, you know, there's always more to learn, but I'm fairly confident that most of our students come out feeling they know what their next steps are.
And you say that you've given over 30 PDCs so far at this point?
We've hosted over 30 PDCs.
Okay.
And I've taught at all of them, but in the early days, I just taught, you know, small segments of the course. And as I became more experienced, more knowledgeable, and did more of my own trainings, I took on more and more teaching roles and responsibilities until I took my teacher training in 2010.
So that was one of the things that was taught to me, was to take that kind of a long approach where to become a permaculture instructor, that you should go take a PDC, spend some time designing your own backyard, get some of that practical knowledge and understanding so you can actually really see the energy flows and how to move water and to track these things and what your local plant communities are, to really get a grounding in your local bioregion.
Absolutely.
And have an idea of what's going on. Then after you've done this for maybe a year or two, to go out and find someone who's teaching a PDC in your area who you know and respect, or perhaps host your own PDC and bring in someone you know and respect and ask them, you know, as we're liaisoning this and as I'm facilitating, can I teach this section or that section of your course so that I can get an understanding of this material and start to get the teaching experience? As opposed to, I got a PDC, I made it through the 72 hours, now I'm going to go teach the full 72 hours next week. That it's this slow build process over a period of years to get there. But, and this is one of the things that I've been trying to get other answers on from people who have been instructing for a while, is what do you see the role of someone who is a permaculture instructor to get there? Like, what training should they go through to get to the point where they're ready to teach a PDC? As opposed to that idea of, like, take the short course and go teach. Do you think that there needs to be a class of professional permaculture instructors that devote themselves to the PDC or perhaps particular advanced training in order to make this material consistent, and so that there are some, like, professional teaching elders, if you will, for people to go to work with, to gain knowledge about this material before they go out and teach it? Or should it be a little bit more freeform so that we don't build that kind of hierarchy and just let people teach as they see fit?
Yeah, you're putting your finger right on it, Scott. That is the debate that goes on between teachers. And that is, do we honor, you know, Bill Mollison's work? He's the one that, you know, laid out the curriculum for the PDC, not David. And, do we honor that no matter what? If we just kind of go forward, or do we say, but our job is to take it and adapt it for the world that we're living in 30 years later? The internet wasn't even around, you know, when we started. So now the information that you used to need to find the teacher and find the book and get the interpretation of what the teacher meant in the book, you had to seek them out and travel and go see them to get this. You know, well, now, 30 years later, all those answers are available in spades on the internet. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, our take on it is that we have to do a much better job than Bill Mollison ever did in developing and delivering design courses. And I don't say that at all in an arrogant way or in a critical way, but rather that's just the process of permaculture, of evolving. Everything evolves. Everything has to grow. And this, you know, permaculture has to do the same thing. And the reason we call it a permaculture design certificate course, and that that's the model that was given us, you know, 25 years ago when Bill created that. I think it's been about that long. That is the framework that we've got. And we've got other programs that we offer. We offer a 6-day hands-on training. We offer a weekend training. And we do get some decent enrollment for these things. And I felt like I needed to take, you know, exciting aspects of the curriculum and put them in more piecemeal, deliver them in piecemeal ways so that people who will never take a design course will at least get fired up about permaculture by taking a weekend training. So those are important to do. But, there is something about the fact that that this thing is out there. It's called a PDC certificate. Mm-hmm. That has a name, it has recognition, and people just say, oh, permaculture, I love this stuff. Oh, I'm going to go get my certificate. So I can offer a training that, you know, if that is the two identical trainings, but if I don't call one a PDC and the other one I do, the one that's called the PDC will have more students at it because it's recognized as the quote-unquote the certificate. Mm-hmm. So in order to deliver the training in good faith, I want to honor the curriculum as it's laid out, but I interpret the curriculum based on where I think we need to go and what students need to know. How many students need to spend an hour learning about what an atoll is, you know, who will never even get to the Pacific Ocean, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to spend time, you know, in a design course focusing on things that they will encounter. How do you build a garden on a concrete lot in the middle of a city? Now that's something that's interesting. And when you can do that, build a garden on a concrete lot in the city, all of a sudden you've got all kinds of possibilities. That's going to affect millions of people's lives. So that's the kind of interpretation that we offer in our courses. We look at the key aspects of the curriculum, but we try to bring in examples that are useful to people in everyday life. So So that answers that question about what do we do? Do we set up this institution that says these are the official teachers and nobody, only those who've gone through these steps should be the teachers? Or do we kind of leave it open? And, you know, even Bill said, you know, at one point in his, one of his writings, he says, you know, we're, you know, it's permaculture, it's free at last, it's uncontrollable, there's our itinerant teachers out there everywhere. You know, we've won. So the extreme of that is, someone can just walk out of a design course and 2 weeks later offer a PDC course, and it can be an awful experience. And unfortunately, there are some people that have done that, not so much the 2 weeks, but not everybody's meant to be a teacher. There are some people that look at a permaculture design course and they think, oh boy, look at this. Look at the money in this. You get 20 students to show up. They all pay, you know, $1,000 to $1,500 a piece. Oh my gosh, this is a gold mine. Well, it ain't. It's an incredible amount of work. And there's a lot of expenses that go with delivering good quality training. But I think that as teachers and in honoring the heart and soul of what permaculture is, permaculture was given by Bill Mollison and David Holmgren as a gift to the world. And I think that we as permaculture teachers have a responsibility that if we're going to teach permaculture, that we do it in a fashion where we can leave students feeling inspired by the material, inspired by the possibilities. So that's the first thing I look for in a teacher is, do they have the ability to convey information that's useful, and they do it in such a way that it inspires other students? Not all of us are meant to do that. So those who are not, I want them to teach a part of a design course and become really experienced. They're the ones that are you're going to go to because they know everything about alternative energy or everything about key lining, and you take students to them to learn that piece. But when it comes to delivering a full design course, you want to have somebody there that can carry the thread, somebody that can carry how these pieces are connected to one another, and leave students with an avenue on where to go next, and inspired by the movement, inspired by the possibilities.
That, I think, answers that perfectly.
It's a tough one, you know. It's and I know how Mollison thinks. The last thing we want to do is have this thing become institutionalized, and all of a sudden, mm-hmm. the only people that are becoming really the teachers are those that, you know, have gone through all this training. And, you know, they had the money and they had the time and they got all these certificates and now they're the official teachers. Well, I know some official teachers or, you know, teachers that have been around a while and they're not very good teachers. I mean, you know, in my opinion, they do not inspire people. They are boring. Some of them are established teachers. And there are others that are, you know, fresh out of the pocket. And they're much more inspiring and have a tremendous amount of knowledge and can convey that to people. We need to create systems whereby we can fan a fire under those folks and get them out there and get them teaching. But I think that as permaculture teachers, and particularly when we deliver design courses, it is our responsibility to be sure that the students get a really solid, well-rounded understanding of permaculture. We owe it to them to do that. We owe it to Bill and David for developing this gift and working, you know, spending a lifetime developing it, and others as well. We owe it to everybody who's been working on this for a decade to deliver something that's worthwhile and inspiring.
And I know from my own experiences from having gone through the PDC and looking at it and thinking, you know what, I'm going to do this. I want to share this with the world. And then go to my teacher training and I start talking with Jude, and she talks about how long it can take to develop a single hour of a module. You know, that you're putting in anywhere from 1 to 20 hours for an hour of material, and you look at that 72 hours and you go, but I've got this giant book with all this information in it, and it's, well, but that needs to be something that you as an individual can deliver. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, it's taking that and reworking the notes, pulling information in from other resources until you have the material that meets your own voice so that you can, you're not standing there just delivering this material by rote. And I mean, that takes time. There's really no way to get around that. I've heard of people teaching at some of the local for-profit universities, and I was at a local coffee shop when they were interviewing with another school, and they were sitting there talking about how, oh, well, I was only 2 or 3 days ahead of my students because all I would do is, after I'd teach a class, I'd go home and I'd read the material for the next day.
Yeah.
Just to get through the next class. Or it's, you know, people would ask questions like, oh, no, we'll get to that. Because that was the only way that they could stave it off until they actually had that material. And I looked at that and it's like, but that doesn't provide the right experience.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, unfortunately, that's where the institution of higher learning has kind of taken us. It's really not about, you know, solving anything. It's not really about creating a fantastic experience of living on this planet. It's really about providing, you know, creating people that have the ability to step into, you know, different aspects of our economy and be quote unquote productive. You know, we really don't want people to think. We really don't want people to, you know, question, is this what we're doing? Is this really important? Or is this really, worthwhile? Or is this what we really want to create? We just want people to show up and shut up and do what they're told to do. And darn it, you know, that is just not going to fly. If we're going to solve some of these problems, we have to be willing to just step out of those molds. One of the most inspiring things doing this work is having people come to our training, the ones that I get to experience, and see them wake up while they're here for just, you know, through the webinars ahead of time, and then while they're here for 8 days, and you see it happening over a period of several days. They start to wake up, and it's like hitting them in the face. And all of a sudden, they kind of have this cathartic moment, and it just falls into place for them, and they walk away from their jobs. They start something new. They follow their gut. They know that there's something important in life that they've been meaning to do, but have been ignoring it because everything in the cult in our culture tells them, "What are you crazy? You're going to lose your health insurance." You know, at some point, you know, they say, "Screw it, I don't give a rat's butt about it." There's so many institutions in our culture that are so far out of whack, and I don't want to call them corrupted, but they're just not helpful to the common good of anybody, except maybe a few executives, you know, and it's even not helpful to them because they're even, you know, for the most part, shut off too. You know, we have to be willing to ask the tough questions. The king has no clothes on, all right? And that's the truth. They're, you know, the king's naked walking around. And nobody wants to see it. I mean, not nobody, but many people. The culture doesn't want to see it. And what permaculture teaches students, I think the number one thing we need to teach students is to reaffirm in them, because they come and they know. People who come to a permaculture course are not in the box. They step out of the box, but many of them are not sure because they don't get a lot of positive reinforcement, for doing that. And their spouse or their family are saying, "Are you crazy? What are you thinking like that for?" And then they come to a course, and not only are they encouraged to look in their gut, what feels right, but we start laying out these paths on ways to solve these problems. And once you've done that, there's just no turning back. You know, there's why stay unconscious? You know, why continue to ride on this ship? So, that's the most gratifying thing to us. And then to get an email from someone who took a course 3, 4, or 5 years ago and just say, "Thank you. You know, this has changed my life. I'm so grateful." But it's not easy. I mean, if we make these changes, we're going to be stepping outside of the stream that's flowing down, you know, full of topsoil down to the ocean. We're going to be stepping outside of that stream, and we're going to start swimming uphill, or we're going to, swimming upstream, or we're going to step out of the stream and start living on the bank and cleaning up, you know, the mess that's allowing for our topsoil to be washed away, you know, metaphorically and practically. I mean, we really are washing away our topsoil. So it takes a lot of strength, and that's one of the other things that, you know, I will address at a design course with students, is I'll tell them that it does take strength, because you're not going to get a lot of support for it. You know, most of us won't get a lot of support, but I just ask them, and then we just allow them to be in that experience, and ask, we have a choice. You know, we got to get up tomorrow. We got to do something with our day, and we can either get up and make a difference, or we can get up and just continue to be part of the challenge, part of the problem.
Yeah, there's an idea that I ran across recently. There are a couple that are kind of in this same theme, and one of them is the idea that you can get up and live every day for yourself, and live a life that may be satisfying for you, but you can get up every day and live your life for others, and in that process, you find your own immortality, because your name and your work continues to live on long after that individual life has passed on. And a movement then from, if you will, an extractive lifestyle to a regenerative one.
Right. That's it. You know, and all we're expressing here, Scott, is we're just expressing how it works.
Yeah.
What permaculture does, and this is what I love about, you know, Bill and David, is what permaculture, it doesn't pass judgment on anything. All it says is what works and what doesn't work. You know, and the things that work, how do we do those, do more of that? And the things that don't work, how do we stop doing those things and find alternatives? That's it. And what you just expressed, and that is when we get up and we live our life, not from the perspective of how do I get mine, but rather how do we create something that works for everybody? That's just the way life works. All of a sudden you step into life and you're engaged and you experience, you know, it's almost a spiritual experience being alive, thinking of working on how do we create something better for everybody, whereby when we start looking and focusing on what do I need and getting stuff just for ourselves, even if we think it's for our families, the world starts to cave in on us. We get sick, it gets dark, we have personal problems, we got physical problems. It's just, it's not healthy. And that's just the way it works. This is not a moral issue at all. It's just, how does it work? It works well. When we work in community, when we work with and for others, we create sustainability, we create permanence, we create abundance. And when we work for ourselves, we basically make our world smaller and smaller and smaller. Even though it may look like we have a big bank account, our experience of being alive is very small, very narrow, and we actually can end up doing a lot of damage to others. So it's just the way it works. There's no judgment there. It's just the way it works. It's a much better, much more enjoyable way to be alive.
And it's a very strange way to be alive, having spent so many years in a different social mold, where it was that whole, there's a book and a film, Fight Club. I don't know if you're familiar with it at all.
And, yeah, I think I did see it.
Okay. Very, very violent film, but there's a conversation between the two main characters where they're going through like this quarter-life crisis, and it has a certain meaning to me and some of the people of my generation because of this idea of a quarter-life crisis, that you've gone through all the steps that your parents taught you. It's, you know, well, what do I do now? Well, just make it through high school. You make it through high school. Well, what do I do now? I don't know, get a job, go to college. You do that, and this process continues and continues and continues until you make it through all these steps. But you're standing there and you just look back on your life and you don't know how you got there or where you're going to go next.
Yep.
And then you step away from that and you become engaged and consciously make a decision to change your life and to do something else that is personally meaningful, regardless of what anybody else feels about that.
Yep.
And when you do that, that sense of personal satisfaction and what you can do not only for yourself and others begins to grow. And it's strange, though, as you continue, at least as myself and some others that I know have gone through this process, is watching the way it becomes like crabs in a barrel. The more that you reach and the more that you grow, as you say, you don't have that support. And then it starts being picked away at and people pull at you, and your ability to get out of that situation and really live this meaningful life, it's a hard road to get there.
It is. It absolutely is. And that's only because we're living in a culture that doesn't honor that. Whereas there have been cultures in the past and there are cultures today that do honor that. We're just in the wrong place. But we're here, you know, so I have a choice. You know, I either stay here and I begin to change the culture. At least I'm not even worried about changing the culture anymore. All I want to do is live authentically today. And that's all I can do. And then and let everybody else do whatever they want to do. I mean, it's kind of a, you know, even a spiritual path in that. I mean, there was a point where I felt like a white knight and somehow I had to save the world. Well, I even gave up on that because, I mean, that doesn't lead anywhere, because who the heck am I to know what the heck is good for everybody? I don't know. But what I do know is what makes me come alive. Thoreau has this great quote that many people have heard. He says that when one advances confidently in the direction of their own dreams and they endeavor to live a life which they have imagined, you know, the life for ourselves, then they will meet with success, unexpected, and in common hours, in everyday moments, common hours. Well, that's exactly how it works. I ran across that quote almost 40 years ago, and I just made the decision. I'm going to follow my gut. I'm going to follow my heart. I'm going to make decisions based on what is it that makes me feel alive, and how do I feel like I can make a contribution. And I have not regretted it. I've gone through some tough times. I've lost everything a couple of times, you know. When I say lost everything, I mean to the outside world, it looks like you lose everything. And they were scary. But when you go through those times and you make it through and you stay true to your goal, not to your goal, you stay true to yourself and you continue to live as authentically as you can, you end up getting these small successes. I mean, to me, Midwest permaculture is one of those things. We had no idea this would work. As a matter of fact, we still don't know if it will work, but we're still here. And, miracles just show up. It's stunning how they happen. I mean, they look like miracles, but you can see it's just how it works. These successes show up unexpected and in common hours. The relationships we develop with others, the gifts that are given to us by others, the doors that are opened to us by others. It's stunning, really. And it's just the way it works. You know, people want to work with people where they feel like there's something there besides just delivering a product. Now, this is a whole lot more than delivering a product. Permaculture is about how do we redesign the way we live on the planet in such a way we take care of the people, we take care of the planet, and we take care of the future. This is big stuff. It's the real deal. And that's to me what this permaculture is about. And as even Bill said, I don't even care what we call it. We don't need to call it permaculture. Let's call it something else. But that's how it works. That's how we are alive. You have to be growing and you have to be contributing. Those are the two things everybody has to do in order to feel alive and worthwhile on this planet and happy. You got to contribute and you got to be learning. You got to do both. You can't do either one. You have to do both. You do that, you're alive. You're here. And it's totally worth it. There's this other quote. I'm going to get a long winded here, but I have to share this one with you, Scott, because this one too I came across about 30 years ago. He's kind of an unknown philosopher from the late 1800s, James Allen. And he wrote a small book called As a Man Thinketh. And in there, there's this one page that just bowled me over. He said that, see if I can get this right, he says, and this was written 100 years ago, so it's written in a man-centric point of view. But he said, a man only begins to be a man when he ceases to whine and revile and commences to search for the hidden justice which regulates all life. And as he adapts his mind to these regulating factors, he ceases to accuse others as the cause of his condition, but builds himself in strong and noble thoughts. He ceases to kick against circumstances, but begins to use these as aids to his more rapid progress and as a means of discovering the hidden powers and possibilities within. And that's how it works. It's like when we stop whining, we stop complaining, we stop pointing fingers, and just start walking an authentic life for ourselves, making the decisions, doing the work we know we came here to do, learning the things we need to learn, being with the people we need to be with, you know. Then we are in a situation where we begin to just grow. We begin to evolve. And we become very strong that way. And we also become kind of like a little point of centeredness wherever we are in our community, wherever we are in our world. You know, we know some of these people at work that no matter how crazy things get, they stay centered. They don't criticize others. They don't put others down. They're strong. They're clear. And, that's the path. We all have to do it. We all have to get there eventually. But that is the path to being connected to source. That is the path. These are the people, you know, when we get there, as we get there, this is how we're going to end up creating permanent culture. We're going to create permanent culture by building solid people. People who are clear, people who are kind. That's what I love about the ethics. I love what Bill and David have created here. So I'm going to do everything I can to honor their work and honor the work of many others who are come behind them and before them. I mean, it's not like they pull it out of their hat and they're the first ones to say, "Hey, we have to live ethically." You know, it's been around a long, long time.
As we continue to search and quest for our right livelihood and the way to do all this, we certainly seem to have a path before us.
Mm-hmm. And it's worth walking. Okay. It's so worth it. I mean, I think about where I was in my past and when I was scared, you know, and when I was afraid I might lose everything, when I was afraid I wasn't, you know, smart enough or important enough or made enough money or whatever all that stuff is. It's so pointless. So empty. And even when you get that stuff, it's not enough. It never is enough because it's not about that. Not about getting that stuff. It's about being something. Not about getting it. It's about being something. And then you just don't need much.
Have you ever heard of the book Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl?
Yes. Uh-huh.
That was one of the first books that was recommended to me that kind of started me down a path of understanding that internal meaning. I happen to have some family members who survived similar experiences to him during World War II. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, hearing their stories as a child growing up and that knowing that these are people who didn't give up regardless of what happened to them and the strength that they found inside themselves because of that meaning that was beyond themselves in order to go through that and understanding how that aids that sense of being. I've studied sociology off and on from time to time, and there's a part of me that wonders if Viktor Frankl's ideas from Man's Search for Meaning had developed earlier rather than Maslow's hierarchy, where you have to meet your physical needs first before you can meet this ever increasing hierarchy of needs, that if Frankl's ideas had been the ones that had kind of made it out of the gate first and into society, what a difference that would make. And towards that sense of growing whole people, and as a parent, how can I do that with my children? So,
that's the thread, Scott, and it's been around. I mean, there's always been, no matter where the human experience has been, there've always been individuals alive on the planet who knew where the source of strength really lied, and how permanence is created, and long-term cultures are created. They've always been there. But we've also had, others who are louder and more vicious, more willing to destroy those people in order to, dominate others. And we're living in a time that where that dominance has been multiplied many times because of the power that we wield with energy, with oil, and these kinds of concentrated energies. We really dominated the planet and dominated other cultures. We have quite a bit of karma here as a species to deal with, but it's what else are we going to do? I mean, all we could do is make choices, find ways to make a contribution, and be a voice for the alternatives, be a voice for what's possible. And I think that's what we've done, this with Becky and I, and our other co-teacher Milton Dixon. That's the voice that we try to give to permaculture, and it's inspiring. It hits home for many of our students. But we also have to have our students leave with some very good practical skills, some really good ideas on what to do next and where to go and what to do. So we got to do both. Somehow we got to do both.
Well, and that goes back to your four major areas that you can build the people while they're there and give them as one part of that, and continue to give them the skills throughout your class. I've had you here for a while. I don't want to keep you any longer this evening, though I imagine we could probably keep down this road for quite some time.
It sounds like it.
Yeah. So rather than tie up the rest of your evening, I can always sometime have you back on. We can talk some more. Is there anything that you'd like to leave the listeners with this evening before we sign off?
No, I don't think so. I think the conversation went wherever it needed to go, and I just trust in that. I just hope that from this conversation, if people are feeling reinforced by those nudges that they've had and those feelings that they need to be focusing on other things, if you're following your heart, you will not lose. You'll hit rough times, or you'll hit some tough stuff, but it is the path. The dreams of the mind are things like skyscrapers and more this, more houses, more cars, more all that kind of stuff. And the dreams of the heart are the ones that really create permanence in a culture. And it also allows us to become alive while we are here. So I just say follow your gut, follow your heart, make those choices, find your people. It's real. It's very real.
Thank you very much, Bill. It's been a deep pleasure to talk with you.
Likewise, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Yep, take care.
See you later. Bye.
Yep. Thank you for joining me for another interview. If you have comments or questions about this or any other episode, go to thepermaculturepodcast.com and leave a message or send me an email. That address is show@thepermaculturepodcast.com. Until the next time, take care of yourself, the earth, and each other.